Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net with me, William English. Continuing this week with the theme of destruction and self-destruction in art, a somewhat deconstructed theme tune composed some time ago by DJ Numpty, distorting the more familiar ticking clock signature. The music playing at the moment in the background is from a series of four CDs by William Baczynski called The Disintegration Loops. Tracks which vary in length from 11 to 63 minutes, but all employing the same strategy. And these are the notes from CD 1 by William Baczynski. In the process of archiving and digitizing analog tape loops from work I had done in 1982, I discovered some wonderful pastoral pieces I had forgotten about, having never recorded them before. Beautiful, lush, cinematic, truly American pastoral landscapes swept before my ears and eyes. With excitement, I began recording the first one to CD, mixing a new piece with a subtle, random, arpeggiated counter melody from the Voyetra. To my shock and surprise, I soon realised that the tape loop itself was disintegrating. As it played round and round, the iron oxide particles were gradually turning to dust and dropping into the tape machine, leaving bare plastic spots on the tape and silence in these corresponding sections of the new recording. I had heard about this happening and frankly was very afraid of this happening to me, since so much of my early work was precariously near the end of its shelf life. Still, I had never actually seen it happen, yet here it was happening. The music was dying. I was recording the death of this sweeping melody. It was very emotional for me and mystical as well. Tied up in these melodies were my youth, my paradise lost, the American pastoral landscape, all dying gently, gracefully, beautifully. Life and death were being recorded here as a whole. Death as simply a part of life, a cosmic change, a transformation. When the disintegration was complete, the body was simply a little strip of clear plastic with a few clinging cords. The music had turned to dust and was scattered along the tape path in little piles and clumps. Yet the essence and memory of the life and death of this music had been saved, recorded to a new media, and remembered. So that's William Baczynski writing on the first of the CD's Disintegration Loops, recorded in 2001. Researching the theme of destruction, I've come across two books of particular interest. Four Dada Suicides, published by the Atlas Press as Anti-Classic 2, and The Destruction of Art by Dario Gamboni. And I'll read extracts from both books now. This is from The Destruction of Art, Iconoclasm and Vandalism Since the French Revolution, by Dario Gamboni. And this piece is all about the suffragettes. Less self-reflexive, but more serious in intent and consequences were the assaults on pictures and buildings made by British feminists in 1913 to 1914. Julius von Wey mentioned this episode briefly in his book of 1915 on iconoclasts, concluding that the art-loving world stood indignant but powerless in front of such means of political agitation. but it has been almost totally forgotten since. With the exception of the damage caused by Mary Richardson to Velázquez's Roque Venus in the National Gallery in London. As this case was the one that was discussed most at the time, it will be simpler to begin with it. The attack happened about 11 a.m. on the 10th of March 1914. A small woman dressed in a tight-fitting grey coat and skirt, who had been standing in front of the Roque Venus for some moments, apparently in contemplation of it, suddenly smashed the glass protecting the canvas and was seen hacking furiously at the picture with a chopper, which it is assumed she had concealed under her jacket. When reached by a constable on duty in the room, she allowed herself to be led away quietly to the inspector's office, saying to a few visitors at the gallery, "Yes, I am a suffragette. You can get another picture, but you cannot get a life, as they are killing Mrs. Pankhurst." The reference was to Emmeline Pankhurst, founder of the suffrage movement and mother of two of its leading exponents, who was then on hunger and thirst strike in Holloway Prison. Mary Richardson was herself, at the time of her arrest, on temporary release from the same prison under the Cat and Mouse Act. She had sent to the Women's Social and Political Union, known as the WSPU, an explanatory statement that was immediately published by the press and deserves to be quoted in its entirety. "I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful woman in mythological history as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history. Justice is an element of beauty as much as colour and outline on canvas. Mrs. Pankhurst seeks to procure justice for womanhood, and for this she is being slowly murdered by a government of Iscariot politicians. If there is an outcry against my deed, let everyone remember that such an outcry is a hypocrisy so long as they allow the destruction of Mrs. Pankhurst and other beautiful living women, and that until the public cease to countenance human destruction, the stones cast against me for the destruction of this picture are each an evidence against them of artistic as well as moral and political humbug and hypocrisy." Before the court, she, that is Mary Richardson, added that she had been a student of art but cared more for justice than for art, so that under the present circumstances, she believed her action to be understandable, if not excusable. In an interview given in 1952, almost 40 years later, Mary Richardson gave yet another reason for her action by saying, "I didn't like the way men visitors gaped at it all day long." Since the turn of the century, the suffrage movement had been engaged in a transformation by the establishment of large organisations using novel tactics to maximise their public exposure. One of these was the WSPU, founded in 1903. Despairing of parliamentary reform, it organised between 1912 and 1914 a further transition from peaceful campaigning to incidents of civil disobedience, guerrilla tactics and open warfare. This spectacular radicalisation involved in particular the destruction of property, for example breaking windows, firing pillar boxes, burning buildings and attacking pictures. A passage from Sylvia Pankhurst's account of the suffrage movement gives both a quantitative and a qualitative idea of this evolution. "The destruction wrought in the 7 months of 1914 before the war excelled that of the previous year. Three Scotch castles were destroyed by fire on a single night. The Carnegie Library in Birmingham was burnt. The Roque be Venus, falsely as I consider attributed to Velázquez and purchased for the National Gallery at a cost of £45,000, was mutilated by Mary Richardson. Romney's Master Thornhill in the Birmingham Art Gallery was slashed by Berta Ryland, daughter of an early suffragist. Carlyle's portrait of Millais in the National Portrait Gallery and numbers of other pictures were attacked. A Bartolozzi drawing in the Doré Gallery being completely ruined. Many large empty houses in all parts of the country were set on fire, including Red Lynch House, Somerset, where the damage was estimated at £40,000. Railway stations, piers, sports pavilions, haystacks were set on fire. Attempts were made to blow up reservoirs. A bomb exploded in Westminster Abbey, and in the fashionable church of St George's, Hanover Square, where a famous stained glass window from Malines was damaged. 141 acts of destruction were chronicled in the press during the first 7 months of 1914. It must be added that the maximum sentence for damaging a work of art was 6 months' imprisonment. Emmeline Pankhurst relates that the magistrate regretfully said to Richardson that if she had smashed a window instead of an art treasure, he could have sentenced her to 18 months, and points out one more queer anomaly of English law. Extracts are from the book Four Dada Suicides. This was published by the Atlas Press in an edition of 1,000 copies. And Four Dada Suicides collects together work by four writers on the fringes of the Dada movement in 1920s Paris. These four took the nihilism of the movement to its ultimate conclusion. Their works are the remnants of lives lived to the limit and then cast aside with nonchalance and disdain. Vacher died of a drug overdose. Rigaud shot himself. Cravan and Torma simply vanished, their fates still a mystery. Yet their fragmentary works, to which they attached so little importance, still exert a powerful allure and were a vital inspiration for the literary movements that followed them. Vacher's bitter humour, Cravan's energetic invective, Rigaud's dandified introspection, and Torma's imperturbable asperity all had their influence. This first extract is about Jacques Rigaud by Terry Hale. Rigaud, a particularly disorganizing intelligence, proved to be a Dada among the Dadas. That is, he demoralized whatever came into contact with him and had not a little to do with the ruin of Dada. In short, he did wonders. And it is he who was right. He was irreconcilable with any need for doing, producing, thinking. The unity of opposites, which had been so much discussed, and of those two opposites which epitomize everything, life and death possessed him entirely. He showed how close he had been to death throughout his life, which ought to be written, by committing suicide in 1929, after having exhausted all the reasons for living a man can offer himself. As might be imagined from these words, during the course of his short life, Rigaud wrote little and published less. The Review Littérature contains one or two short pieces by him, the last appearing in 1922, but from then on until the time of his death 7 years later, he maintained an almost unbroken silence. As with Jacques Vacher, who is known to us only through his Lettres de Guerre and André Breton's Reminiscences, Rigaud's influence on the development of the surrealist movement around this time could have passed almost without trace. Like Vacher as well, Rigaud's principal contribution was perhaps his total world weariness and cynical humour. Drieu La Rochelle first wrote about Rigaud in 1924, an unpleasant short story entitled La Valise Vide, The Empty Suitcase. After Rigaud's suicide, he deeply regretted having penned this piece, confiding in his diary, "I killed you, Rigaud. I could have warmed you against my breast." This did not prevent him from writing a novel concerning the last few days of Rigaud's life, Le Feu Follet, 1931, translated as Will o' the Wisp and published by Calder and Boyers in 1966, which was filmed in 1963 by Louis Malle. In Dreyer's novel, Rigo, who is called Alain, is portrayed as a victim of the directionless hedonism of the 1920s, one whose existential crisis could simply have been resolved by a steady job, a more disciplined society. No doubt Dreyer's bourgeois readership found something reassuring in these trite assumptions. The following is a piece by Jacques Rigo, which actually wasn't published until 1959. It's entitled The General Suicide Agency. A state-licensed company, capital 5 million francs, main Paris office, 73 Boulevard Montparnasse, branches in Lyon, Bordeaux, Marseille, Dublin, Monte Carlo, San Francisco. As a result of technological advances, the GSA is pleased to announce to its clients that it can now guarantee them an instantaneous death. This service cannot fail to be of interest to those who have previously been deterred from committing suicide for fear of making a mess of it. It is with a view to the elimination of the unhappy and the desperate, who always represent a dangerous source of contagion in society, that the Minister of the Interior has graciously consented to act as our honorary president. Amongst other benefits, the GSA at last offers a reputable method of passing away, death being the least excusable of moral failings. That is why we have organised an express burial service. Meal, viewing by friends and relations, photographs or death masks if preferred, distribution of effects, suicide, placing in coffin, religious ceremony optional, transport of the body to the cemetery. The GSA pledges itself to carry out the last wishes of its esteemed clients. In the event of the establishment not being close to a main thoroughfare, the corpse will be conveyed to the morgue in order to ensure the peace of mind of those families who so desire it. And this is followed by a price list. Electrocution, 200 francs. Revolver, 100 francs. Poison, 100 francs. Drowning, 50 francs. Perfumed death, inclusive of luxury tax, 500 francs. Hanging, the suicide of the poor, 5 francs. The rope is charged at 20 francs per metre, plus 5 francs for every additional 10 centimetres. Ask for our special express burials catalogue. All inquiries to Monsieur J. Rigo, Principal Director, 73 Boulevard Montparnasse, Paris, 75006. Correspondents requesting a wish to attend a suicide shall be ignored. Concerned with forging a literary reputation for himself, either during his own lifetime or for the benefit of posterity. That any of his writings should have been published at all during his short life happened less by design than by accident, or more precisely as a result of coincidence, and usually occurred against his better judgment. Finally, like Rigo, although on the edge, fairly unwillingly in Torma's case of Dada, circles in Paris from the beginning of the 1920s onwards, his ideas were so nihilistic, even by the standards of the epoch, that his writing occasionally assumes a quality which could be mistaken for pastiche by the unwary. As we shall see, Torma's utter rejection of all forms of commitment, whether political, social, religious, or moral, owes less to the Parisian Dada milieu than to Alfred Jarry's Science of Sciences, Pataphysics. Julian Torma's first book, La Lampe Obscure, was published in February 1920 by the proprietor of a small bookshop and publishing house, whom the author had met by accident in a cafe Tormer, by now in his late teens, had just been dismissed from the lowly position he occupied on the local paper. The book itself is a collection of erotico-mystical poems owing something or nothing in style to the poet Max Jacob, whom Tormer had met the previous year. In any event, the collection represents an astonishing achievement, particularly in its use of puns, palindromes, spoonerisms, and other devices, for an 18-year-old boy from a broken family. The following year, René Daumal came across a copy of La Lampe Obscure on one of the bookstalls on the Paris Quays. Tormer, for reasons which are explained in a letter to Robert Deneau, had deliberately neglected to inform him of the existence of this early collection of poetry. Daumal twisted Tormer's arm to write him a long dedication. Tormer's reluctance, mentioned earlier, to participate in any kind of literary movement is clearly evident from the following letter. The ascendancy which your culturelessness has given you. We can undertake nothing without you. The very fact that you turned Roger down flat bestows upon you personally the principal weight of the void. There is a force about you which is bewildering because it rests on nothing. It is this nothing which is precious.